Today is Monday, September the 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. U.S. President Joe Biden will announce new steps to slow the spread of COVID-19 before the U.N. General Assembly meets in September.
We also know this virus transcends borders. I'll be announcing additional steps to help the rest of the world later this month.
In 20 years after the September 11th attacks this weekend, the U.S. commemorated with a ceremony at Ground Zero that included three presidents. In Lebanon, following year-long political paralysis, the country finally has a new government. But will this be enough to revive its economy?
They kept the same sectarian network, the same system. They didn't change anything. Nothing new, same old.
And plus my conversation with Seth Radwell, author of a new book, American Schism, How the Two Enlightenments Hold the Secret to Healing Our Nation. That's all coming up right here on VOA's International Edition. Stay tuned. 20 years after the September 11th attacks, the U.S. commemorated with a ceremony at the Ground Zero that included family members of those killed, three presidents, and Bruce Springsteen was among the performers. AP correspondent Julie Walker has more.
Biden, Obama, and Clinton stood side by side somberly at the National September 11 Memorial. The president left the speaking to family members like Mike Lowe, who lost his daughter, Sarah, a flight attendant on one of the hijacked planes.
I find sustenance in a continuing appreciation for all of those who rose to be more than ordinary people.
Another speaker, Springsteen, who performed I'll See You in My Dreams.
May God bless our fallen brothers and sisters.
I'll see you in my dream when all our summers have come to an end.
Most of the almost 3,000 people that died on 9/11 were in New York. At Ground Zero, I'm Julie Walker.
U.S. President Joe Biden will announce new steps to slow the spread of COVID-19 before the U.N. General Assembly meets. That's according to U.S. Surgeon General Dr. Vivek Murthy. Reuters has more.
I'll be announcing additional steps to help the rest of the world later this month.
U.S. President Joe Biden will announce new steps to slow the spread of COVID-19 before the U.N. General Assembly meets on Tuesday. That's according to Surgeon General Vivek Murthy, who said on CNN Sunday, quote, "There will be more actions that we continue to work on, especially on the global front." Murthy did not specify what those actions would be. He also defended Biden's efforts to expand the vaccination effort in the United States.
We also know this virus transcends borders.
Biden on Thursday said he would require federal workers to be vaccinated against COVID-19 and mandate that large employers either require their workers to be vaccinated or get tested regularly. Biden also said the United States had donated 140 million vaccine doses to more than 90 other countries.
More than all other countries combined, including Europe, China, and Russia combined. That's American leadership on a global stage. And that's just the beginning.
The next session of the General Assembly opens Tuesday. The first day of general debate will be the following week.
You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. As the U.S. commemorates the 20th anniversary of the deadliest attack on its soil, scholars look back at this inflection point in the country's history and question whether it explains some of the divisions we currently see in American politics. Political analysts say that the resurgence of nationalist politics, a contentious election season capped by the attack on the Capitol on January the 6th, highlighted some of the divisions that shaped the development of the American Democratic Republic, including questions about America's role as a global leader. Seth Radwell, author of a new book, American Schism, How the Two Enlightenments Hold the Secret to Healing Our Nation, says that even though the Founding Fathers viewed American democracy as a great model for the rest of the world, they did not envision America becoming the police or enforcer of that form of democracy across the world. Seth, let's start off our conversation. First of all, thank you very much for joining us today on the show. People see this moment and the current, corrosion and division in American politics
the culture wars and say that, and others, and say that, you know, we don't recognize this America. But are these new to America? Where do we trace our divisions as we see them currently in America?
Well, Jackson, first of all, it's a pleasure to be here with you. That was exactly the question that led me to take a three-year hiatus from my business career to write American Schism. And I was not understanding how it could be that the American society that I had grown up in, the American dream, which I kind of took part in, how we ended up becoming a society that was so bitterly divisive and that was characterized by rancor and acrimony, completely crowding out respectful political discourse. So it was that was what led me to this project. And I was intent on tracing, I was convinced that it wasn't new, that there's always been divisions in America. And so I tried to find out where they came from. And in some ways, what American Schism, the book is an investigative tracing of where those divisions come from.
So as we commemorate the 20th anniversary of the deadliest attack on American soil, when you look back, how did this moment, how did 9/11 shape these divisions or the schisms?
I think it is a demarcation point. Certainly 9/11 was a tragic episode. And I guess why it's most relevant to me now is that in many ways, how bitter and divided we are today is tragic, because after 9/11, there was a period of time when we were quite unified as a country, when we came together and empathized with each other and reinforced the elements of what make up the American credo, a lot of elements of why we were founded as a nation in the first place. And it seems like, in a way, we've wasted that unity that we had established because we've become so divided. So I think it is a symbol, 9/11, for sure. And in many ways, my wish for Americans is that they could recapture some of the shared values that we celebrated in the aftermath of 9/11, which seemed to have been lost.
And is this schism exceptionally American? Is it what drives the philosophy of American exceptionalism?
Well, so precisely. So the book goes back to our founding during the Enlightenment, and it articulates that there were two contending schools of thought, two different visions, if you will, of the country that were formed back then. And it pitted our founding fathers against each other. On one hand, you had Thomas Jefferson and Thomas Paine and Benjamin Franklin, who had one vision of America. And then you had people like John Adams and Alexander Hamilton, who had a very different vision. And so what I show in the book is how the divisions that we have today trace back, in fact, to that original split of what became the Federalists and the Democratic Republicans. And there is a definite tracing that's useful. In fact, Jackson, what the book does, after describing that early part of our history as being so important, it then examines five episodes of our history using this frame of these two competing schools of the Enlightenment as a lens to make sense of what happened. And then in the third part of the book, it actually distills core lessons and lays out a path forward in terms of how we can heal our divide. And I think that's going to require both structural changes and mindset changes that we as Americans need to embrace.
Mm. And speaking about moving forward, for those saying that, you know, we are tired and we want to work towards healing and unifying this country, what lessons will they learn from this book about the compromises, you know, again, based on facts and the truth that the founding fathers had to make as they embarked on this American experiment?
What they'll find is a couple of things. The first thing they'll find is that in our history, we've had many, many periods of disagreement, sometimes vehement disagreement, which became, of course, quite violent, like in the Civil War. But we've made the most progress when we've been able to forge compromises and recognize that even though we're very different, the original 13 colonies were very different. When we work together, we have, and we compromise and forge solutions, we have an ability to do exceptional things. And I would say that, you know, the reason why America became the beacon of hope in the world is not because of our military might or because of what we just tried to do in Afghanistan. The reason why we became so envied are two things. One is, and this the book shows this, one is our experiment in self-government, which, while far from perfect, has been the most transparent and successful and open of any society in the history of the world. And the second thing is our model of meritocracy. While, again, far from perfect, has allowed people to come here and succeed without needing to be nobly born or born into a rich family. Now, the book also explains how these are ideals which need to be perfected. And we've made, at different periods of our history, we've done better at our experiment in self-government and in building a meritocracy than in others. The book will also explain that unless we re-embrace a civic and respectful political dialogue founded in reason and objective truth, our democracy is doomed. We cannot have a democracy where everyone thinks they have their own truth, which is what's happening today.
That was Seth Rodwell, author of a new book, American Schism, How the Two Enlightenments Hold the Secret to Healing Our Nation. I reached him in California.
Voice of America!
The Taliban have announced that women in Afghanistan will be allowed to continue to study in universities, but with segregated classrooms and Islamic dress as compulsory measures. AP correspondent Karen Chamas reports.
The announcement came as Qatar's foreign minister arrived in Kabul, the highest profile visitor since the Taliban announced their new interim cabinets. The Minister for Higher Education, Abdulbaki Haqqani, unveiled the new policies to the media a few days after a new all-male government was formed. Any female students who continues their studies with Islamic hijab, the Islamic Emirate has no problem with them. The world has been watching closely to see to what extent the Taliban might act differently from their first time in power in the late 1990s. During that era, girls and women were denied an education and were excluded from public life. I'm Karen Chamas.
Following a year-long political paralysis that has sunk its economy, Lebanon finally has a new government. Analysts wonder, though, whether Prime Minister Najib Mikati, the country's richest man, will deliver the needed reforms to revive the ailing nation and rescue Lebanon from bankruptcy. Analysts say his cabinet reinforces the country's crippling sectarianism, and Gulf Arabs will be unlikely to provide financial help as long as an Iran-backed Hezbollah maintains a stronghold on power. For VOA, Del Gavlak reports.
Pressing Lebanese politicians to end their political bickering over portfolios, the U.S. and France welcomed the new government, saying urgent action must be taken to tackle the country's dire economic crisis, especially after the deadly Beirut port blast in August of last year. Lebanese analyst Dania Kholiat Khatib with the Issam Faris Institute at the American University of Beirut told VOA that after more than 13 months of waiting for a new government, the Lebanese people are disappointed with the resulting cabinet and desperate to stop the slide toward poverty and chaos they're experiencing. Most critically, she says, that the finance minister, who needs to resume talks with the International Monetary Fund on unlocking badly needed financial support, is viewed as unlikely to be tough enough on his former employer, the central bank, which is widely blamed for Lebanon's bankruptcy.
They kept the same sectarian network, the same system. They didn't change anything. Nothing new. Same old, because still there will not be any reforms unless the Ministry of Finance is free, put by a really independent person. And the Ministry of Finance is put to Youssef Al-Khalil. So unless there is a real forensic audit, you cannot do any reforms. There are some good people, like Nasser Yassin, Minister of Environment. But it's not enough to put few good names unless you have a structure where they can work from.
Few observers believe the government will oversee a thorough financial audit of the central bank because securing IMF support would require reforms that past governments have failed to enact. The public blames these same ruling parties for decades of corruption and mismanagement of Lebanon's resources. Getting financial help from Gulf Arabs would mean confronting Hezbollah's substantial influence. Analyst Sami Mobayed, writing in Dubai's Gulf News, noted that Hezbollah is in charge of the Public Works Ministry, which is very important for the Iran-backed party, since this is where all the money will pour when or if the reconstruction of Beirut begins. Former Prime Minister Saad Hariri, he said, had persistently refused giving them this ministry, fearing that this will hamper reconstruction, scare off Arab investors, and possibly trigger sanctions from the United States. Some observers say that Mikati's government may try to implement some modest reforms to secure votes for the traditional sectarian parties. The focus now is on Lebanon's municipal, parliamentary, and presidential election scheduled for next year, Khatib says.
Now the whole conversation will be on running for the election. I don't think the election will bring real change because the power structure is put in a way to perpetuate itself and the opposition is not well organized.
Meanwhile, most Lebanese are struggling to survive amid soaring inflation and the more than 90% loss in the value of their currency, coupled with fuel and medicine shortages and severe power cuts. Dale Gavlek for VOA News.
And in more headline news, North Korea says that it successfully test-fired a new long-range cruise missile over the weekend. That's according to the country's state-run Korean Central News Agency, KCNA. The report says that the country's Academy of Defense Science successfully test-fired the missiles on September 11th and 12th, and that the weapons had been in development for 2 years. And in Brazil, several hundred Brazilians protested against the president, Jair Bolsonaro, and demanded his impeachment in Sunday demonstrations called by conservative groups days after a massive mobilization supporting the country's embattled far-right leader.
Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. The human rights records of more than 40 countries will come under scrutiny by the 47-member United Nations Human Rights Council during its upcoming four-week session. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The session promises to be extremely busy. Nearly 90 reports on a wide range of thematic issues will be presented. They include torture, enforced disappearances, the right to development, slavery, the rights of people of African descent, and racism. As in previous years, the Council's laser lens focus on the way governments treat their people is expected to garner a lot of attention. Reported abuses, some amounting to crimes against humanity, will be examined in countries such as Myanmar, Belarus, Syria, Eritrea, Burundi, Nicaragua, and Venezuela. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet will present an oral update on the situation in Afghanistan Monday as a follow-up to the Council's August 24th special session on that country. The European Union, Mexico, and Britain, along with human rights activists, have criticized the resolution that was adopted for failing to establish a robust independent mechanism to monitor violations by the Taliban. Council President, Fiji Ambassador Nazar Shamin Khan, says discussion on Afghanistan has not ended with the special session.
And really, it's a matter for states to decide whether they want to take the outcome of the special session further and achieve another result. But I do want to note the Security Council on the 30th of August adopted a resolution on safe passage. It addressed human rights concerns, particularly as it relates to women and children.
Human Rights Watch Executive Director Kenneth Roth says he is dismayed at the Council's reluctance to take on powerful countries such as Russia and China. He says he fears the Kremlin will not be held to account for its unprecedented crackdown on opposition parties in advance of this month's parliamentary elections.
Ideally, we'd like to have a resolution At minimum, there should be a joint statement. But again, this is a situation that just because the government is relatively powerful should not mean that it escapes scrutiny. And this is, you know, again, a bit of a test of the council's credibility.
Roth says the same dynamics are playing out regarding China's abusive treatment of more than a million Uyghurs in internment camps in Xinjiang province.
You know, China's always escaped formal scrutiny by the council. There's never been a resolution on China. It's time to end that, given the severity of the atrocities, the crimes against humanity being committed in Xinjiang.
China maintains the Uyghurs are being held in re-education camps and that the vocational training they are receiving is necessary to counter terrorism and alleviate poverty. Roth is calling on Bachelet to present a report describing the inhumane conditions under which the Uyghurs are being incarcerated and to call for the Chinese government to be held accountable. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Our next report takes us to Botswana in Southern Africa, which once held the world's highest coronavirus infection rates. It has now seen a drastic reduction in transmission. The COVID-19 task force reported Thursday that the Southern African country has seen a six-fold reduction in cases, the first time since the pandemic began. From Habarone, Botswana, Kondisi Dube has the details.
In July, Botswana was recording an average of 67 cases per 100,000 people, making the country one of the top five COVID-19 hotspots in the world. Last month, President Mokgweetsi Masisi painted a gloomy picture as the country faced an unprecedented rise in infections.
We have recorded an exponential increase in positive cases and fatalities, severely straining our fragile healthcare system. Our nation has attained the highest prevalence ever. Evidence of deaths is conspicuous and worrisome to all of us.
But after recording more than 2,000 deaths in the last 4 months, Botswana is now breathing a sigh of relief with a drop in the infection rate. Musipili Musipili is the COVID-19 Task Force Vice Chairperson.
On this day of the 6th of September, Botswana had an estimated 3,302 active cases, a six-fold drop in the highest number of active cases that this country has ever experienced during the current surge.
Botswana had seen its COVID-19 vaccination program slow down at the end of a devastating third wave. But there was more positive news this week as the country received 400,000 doses of China's Sinovac vaccines, the highest thus far. President Masisi says at least 64% of the eligible adult population will be fully vaccinated by the end of October.
The total number of vaccines expected this month, together with those that have been received so far, will mean that by the end of October 2021, 975,782 Botswana will be fully vaccinated, translated into 64% of the target population being fully vaccinated.
Nearly 10% of Botswana's population, or 220,000 people, are fully vaccinated. At least 361,878 people have received a single dose of the vaccine. For VOA, this is Mkondisi Dube in Habaroni, Botswana.
The World Health Organization says low-income countries still do not have enough COVID-19 vaccines and is urging wealthier nations to deliver more doses. VOA's Mariama Diallo has this report.
The World Health Organization Director General sounded the alarm again on the short supply of COVID-19 vaccines in low-income countries.
Globally, 5.5 billion vaccine doses have now been administered. But 80% have been administered in high and upper middle-income countries.
He says despite talk about the importance of vaccine availability worldwide, there has been little action to tackle shortages in low-income countries.
High-income countries have promised to donate more than a billion doses, but less than 15% of those doses have been materialized. Manufacturers have promised to prioritize COVAX and low-income countries. We don't want any more promises. We just want the vaccines.
As of last month, the United States had donated more than 110 million doses to more than 60 countries worldwide. The director general, who opposes the widespread use of booster jabs for healthy people, also called for an extension of the moratorium on such shots beyond its original September deadline. This comes as Israel became the first country to offer booster shots to people over the age of 60. The country has since expanded its program to include frontline workers and people 40 and over. Yokeve Leaker, a Jerusalem resident who recently got vaccinated. Earlier this month, France also made the offer to people over 65 and to those with underlying health conditions. Cicely Tatogan, a medical student who's helping administer the shots at a pharmacy in Paris, explains.
Over time, there's a drop in antibodies for people who were vaccinated just over 6 months ago. And so we want to give a booster to increase the levels of antibodies for those who did it a while ago and are at risk, people with deficient immune systems and elderly people with existing conditions.
Canada and Germany have also announced booster campaigns. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
Some of Australia's biggest media companies have lost a battle with the former youth detainee over allegedly defamatory comments posted about him on their Facebook pages. The High Court has found the media groups are legally responsible as quote-unquote publishers for third parties' comments on their Facebook pages. From Sydney, Phil Masser reports.
Dylan Voller was held in youth detention in Australia's Northern Territory. His treatment was the focus of a 2016 television documentary, which led to a wide-ranging inquiry into the mistreatment of inmates. Images of him shackled to a chair wearing a spit hood sparked outrage. They also prompted some Facebook users to make allegedly defamatory remarks about him on the media company's pages online. As a result, Voller wants to sue several Australian media companies. The case has been held up by a separate legal dispute over whether the outlets were the publishers of users' comments. The High Court, Australia's highest court, Wednesday found they were, because in setting up a public Facebook page and posting content, the media groups had allowed and encouraged comments from the platform's users. The judges said it didn't matter that the companies deleted the messages after becoming aware of them. A spokesperson for Australia's Nine Network, which is one of the companies involved, said we're obviously disappointed with the outcome, as it will have ramifications for what we can post on social media in the future. Voller's lawyer, Peter O'Brien, told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, Voller is relieved the long legal fight, or stoush in Australian parlance, is over.
I spoke to Dylan this morning. He's obviously elated at the decision. It's been a long legal stoush. People who might be vulnerable to social media mob attacks, they're protected.
The High Court decision clears the way for Voller to continue his legal action against high-profile newspapers, the Sydney Morning Herald and The Australian, and others including broadcaster Sky News. The defamation case will continue later in the New South Wales State Supreme Court. A trial there will decide whether the Facebook comments did in fact defame the former youth detention inmate. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great week ahead.
In the public interest from VOA Africa.
The World Health Organization and Africa Center for Disease Control say we all can help fight the global pandemic by frequently washing our hands with soap and water or using hand sanitizers. For more information on protecting yourself and others, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa Center for Disease Control. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.